Jack, he used the word enthusiastically a few minutes ago about going to Vietnam. When you realized you were going to Vietnam, what was your attitude about taking part in the war?
David, you know, you have 40, 50 years to reflect. Much like Bill, you get things become very poignant, I guess. But I remember basically not having any problem at all with going to the war. I mean, the Army kind of puts you in a place sometimes where you just do what you're told. But and let me stop for just a second. What a story, right? I wish they had let me go first. We had some folks that ended up being prisoners, and we looked for them for a long time. And I remember watching the TV shows. Might have been the day you were released, when they would show the names at the end of the news. And I finally saw those two guys' names, and it was like a breath of something had come out of me. But back to the question, David. We basically just operated like young people will operate. And we just took it, as Bill said, one day at a time. They'd hand you a mission sheet. You had this stuff to do today. You'd go do it. Some days it got a little exciting. Some days it didn't. But for the most part, I don't ever remember thinking enthusiasm, but I guess really we did have it. Yeah.
You flew Hueys.
I did.
Assault units, assault helicopters, right?
Correct.
What does that mean? What missions fall under that umbrella of assault helicopters?
In the 1st Cavalry Division, they would divide each battalion, and you'd have one company. There'd be four companies. One company would be devoted to aerial gunnery support. There was always a shouldn't in our in division or in our division. There was a heavy lift group that was the Chinook helicopters, the twin rotor things, and then you had two Huey outfits. One specifically tasked with resupply missions, and the other one was combat assault. I just happened to end up with Charlie Company of the 229th, and that's what we did. So we were the guys that would go in formations of seven to sometimes more helicopters. We'd pick the troops up in a secure location. We'd have a mission planned to take them from one part of the area of operation to the other, and we'd insert those guys into a non-secure area, which basically involved a lot of pre-planning and pre-preparation using artillery and various other things that would ensure at least a safe arrival for them. Once they got them on the ground, it was up to them to defend themselves. But our job was just that combat assault role.
Now, you were on the Cambodian border, yes? Near the Cambodian border?
Right. The unit had moved from the what they called I Corps. It moved down from the northern part of Vietnam after the 68 offensive. And we took up residence in a little place called Tay Ninh, which was in that picture of Vietnam. It was down in the southern fat part, kind of out on the Cambodian border. And that's where we operated out of.
So what were the rules? To what extent were you able to go into Cambodia?
We weren't allowed to go into Cambodia until May 1st of 1970.
Okay, there we are. May 1st, 1970. What happened?
May Day. President Nixon had decided that we needed to interdict into Cambodia to get a little more control over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And of course, as Bill mentioned, there was a lot of fingers of it that joined up there. So they authorized us to go into Cambodia.
Let me interrupt for a second. Explain, you know, in the introduction, we showed the sliver of Vietnam and there's Cambodia and Laos. And explain the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Why was it so important? What was going on that the North Vietnamese were doing on the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
Dear goodness, I just read some new information that I hadn't read before. But the North Vietnamese, with the help of the Russians, the Chinese, and all that, they had to keep a supply line going. And as they developed this guerrilla, if you will, operation in the southern part of Vietnam. The idea was they had to keep things moving to them. And the biggest mistake that we made in pressing this war was we somehow thought that we could stop that. That if we just blew enough stuff up, it would work. They could rebuild that, hack out a new trail overnight. It took nothing for them to do that. But it was there. It was the major supply line into the southern part of the country. Right. And they moved a lot of stuff.
All right, so May 1st, 1970. What was the mission? How big was it? How many air helicopters?
Oh, I've still got the mission sheet at home. We started out the day with knowing where we were going to pick people up. But the landing zones, which would normally be coordinates or something on a map, those were basically listed as to be determined, which meant that it was a secret. And we left, I can't remember, the first couple of missions were fairly benign. We were moving people into position. But we got them all located in a large installation right up on the border called Quan Loi. It was not right next to the Michelin rubber plantation. As a matter of fact, that's where your tires come from. But we started hauling these people out. And we knew we were going to go deep into Cambodia. There was a limit, 23 kilometers or something like that. But we knew we were going deep in. And the idea was we had to get as big a force on the ground at one time as possible. The largest formation that we took part in that day had 48 Hueys and 18 Cobra gunships escorting him.
How unusual was that many airplanes?
Oh, I had never seen anything like it. It looked like D-Day or something. You know, we normally operated in 5 to 7 ship formations. But what they did, they just took different companies and combined them together. Put one flight leader out in front of us, and we just followed him. We crossed the Cambodian border. Previously, we had done a lot of extraction of ammunition and supplies and food that had been stored there for the next assault. They found that, and so we were one of the few units that literally really knew where the border was. We worked there every day, right? And I remember crossing the border thinking, is this the right thing to do?
You had another mission that was a resupply mission that went south on you. What happened that day later?
Oh, well, that was the extraction, actually. We had some troops that, frankly, it was a very benign mission. We were just going in for a single lift, a single sortie extraction. 7 ships, literally 10 kilometers from our base camp. It was basically in what we thought was a secure area, if there was anything like that in Vietnam. We made our approach, realizing that we were going to extract everybody out at one time, which meant there was nobody we were the only defense that we had. And of course, we had our Cobras standing by if we needed it. That just turned into a situation. They started getting contact as the last groups were coming out of the tree lines, and we had to stay there, obviously, to do what we were supposed to do. And I was the last, maybe second to last ship out.
How many people were you able to pull out of there? And how much did you get shot up?
I didn't take any hits that day. We got shot out quite a bit, but for some reason I didn't take any hits. But we probably pulled, I guess that was 7 ships. We probably pulled 45 or 50 guys out in that one lift. And of course, there again, like I say, it got exciting there at the end when we suddenly realized that we couldn't let the Cobras shoot until we got all the people out of the fields. Once they were out of the tree lines, then they opened up. So it worked, all worked out for the best. We didn't have anybody hurt or lost or anything.
When you got back to the States, what was the attitude toward you when you came back to the States, and what's your reflection on what the attitude was in the country about the war when you came back?
I was from the South. I lived in Memphis, Tennessee at the time. DeRosed back to the States and landed in Oakland, California. Went through my out processing. Got on an airplane, put on my civilian clothes, got on an airplane, and other than my haircut, nobody could tell who I was. So I never experienced any of the terribly bad stories that you hear about. A lot of that had to do with coming into civilian airports in uniform. That's when you would see those types of things. So my personal experience was very benign compared to a lot of that.
Bill, what about you when you, after your second tour and came back?
Yeah, well, second tour was definitely different than the first tour. First tour of duty, we came back into McChord Air Force Base in Washington. We got off the airplane and went into a little room in the operations area there, and there was an Air Force officer that briefed us. And that the briefing was essentially, hey, what you guys remember when you left is different now. There is a lot of anti-war sentiment, and we advise if you go into town or anywhere, you just don't wear your uniform would not be a good thing to do. I never, never got in a situation where I feared for my life or safety or anything, but there were reactions of civilians that they would take out their frustrations on the soldiers and yell things like baby killer to us, when in fact, like today, we were just military personnel serving our country and doing our duty, and the questions and issues they might have had with the war would be more appropriately directed in a political direction rather than a military direction. I've been so pleased today to see the response and the reaction to our soldiers coming back from conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq. Whether it's popular or not popular, the soldiers are always treated well, and that makes me feel very, very good and very nice. On my second tour of duty, that was a fantastic homecoming. I mean, we landed in the Philippines. It was the middle of the night. There were hundreds of people screaming and yelling and waving flags and lights, and that continued on through our stop in Hawaii on the way home, and then arrival at Travis Air Force Base. And I went to Fitzsimmons Hospital in Denver, and when we landed there, Buckley Air Base, very positive response, positive reaction by everyone.